Hey y'all, before we get started, I wanted to let you know that the new U.S. Nationwide Suicide and Crisis Hotline is now active. You can call or text 988 if you need help. Please remember that you are not alone. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. I wondered today how long it had been since I had covered a case of domestic violence that ended in murder. It felt like it had been too long. Unfortunately, there are so many types of victims who need our attention. Cases that cry out for us not to forget. And there are so many types of killers that we want and need to understand. I need to also warn you that today's episode also deals with child abuse, but I've tried to minimize the details so you won't shy away, because Yana and Peter's story deserves to be heard. As is so often the case, an abuser doesn't just target his spouse or partner. There are the small children who cannot speak for themselves or who are not listened to when they try. We always need the victims to know we care and that there are resources. I tell these stories so we don't forget. Yana Huss, like Sheila Bellish and so many before her, tried to do everything right to get help. She called the police so many times that I literally lost count and couldn't even total the number when I went back to look, because there are not solid records on every call. But unlike Sheila, she had no family or friends here. Yana was an immigrant. She moved to this country on a marriage visa. She wanted a better life for herself and her young son, Peter. Born in Ukraine, Yana was fleeing Russia, where her first husband had been murdered. The United States and a loving husband to protect her seemed like the answer to her prayers. She couldn't know she was walking into the arms of a monster. She couldn't know just how isolated and alone she would be. And she couldn't know just how badly our American justice system would fail her and her son. Welcome to episode 158, Murder in Slow Motion, The Death of Yana Huss. At around 11 a.m. on April 25, 2007, a woman named Joyce Huss was in her Longwood, Florida house when she heard her dogs barking. She looked out her window and saw her 8-year-old step-grandson, Peter. He was standing alone on the sidewalk holding a suitcase. Joyce called her son, Scott, to see why Peter was outside her house. He told her, "Don't tell anyone, don't call anybody." Scott didn't want anyone to know he had just dropped Peter off, but he wouldn't say why. Joyce thought the situation was odd, but she didn't have much time to think about it. She had lunch plans with her other son, Michael. So Joyce scooped up Peter, and they drove to pick up Michael. When he got in the car, Michael noticed that Peter had some bloodstains on his shirt. Peter then explained that his mother, Yana, had been stabbed in the arm by a man who had broken into the house. Incredibly, Joyce and Michael didn't think much of Peter's comment because they still went to lunch. Later, Joyce dropped Michael off and Peter told them, "My mom is dead. My mom is dead." And Joyce and Michael still did nothing. In fact, she nonchalantly took Peter to Walmart to buy some new clothes to replace his bloody ones. After they returned home, Joyce opened up the suitcase Peter had been dropped off with. Inside was a 12-page manifesto written by her son, Scott. Finally, Joyce realized something was wrong. I guess more wrong than a man supposedly breaking in her daughter-in-law's home and stabbing her. Joyce called the police and asked that a welfare check be conducted on Peter's mother, Yana. Officers went to Yana's Port Charlotte, Florida home to see if she was okay. But she wasn't. Yana had been viciously attacked with a knife. It was clear from her wounds that this was personal. This was a rage killing. Hoping to find out more about the man who stabbed Yana, officers went to speak with Peter, who told them he had lied about what really had happened to his mom. It wasn't a strange man who broke into his house. It was his stepfather, Scott Huss. He said, "He made me say that happened. I lied because I'm afraid of him. I was afraid he'd hurt me like he hurt my mom." I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Scott Lee Huss was born on August 6, 1958, in Newton, North Carolina. We weren't able to find much about his childhood. We do know that as an adult, Scott was close to his mother Joyce, but not his father John. While attending DeLand High School, Scott met his first wife, Laura. After graduating, Scott joined the Air Force. According to his resume, he reached the rank of sergeant. In June 1977, during the break between boot camp and technical training, Scott went home and married Laura. She moved to Austin, Texas with him, and they lived at Fort Bergstrom Air Force Base for 4 years. They had two children together, Danielle and Jeremy. When the kids were older, Danielle became estranged from her father. But Jeremy later testified that he lived with his dad from age 15 through 18. Scott was a loving father, he said. We had a normal loving father-son relationship. When Jeremy became an adult, the relationship was strained, and they didn't talk as often. Laura later told police that after a year or so of marriage, she realized Scott was, quote, a very disturbed person, and had been for a very long time. He was physically abusive. Laura never called the police on Scott because she said the abuse was always the result of a blow-up when he had been drinking. She said it didn't go on for hours, and he was always sorry when it was over. Laura told police about a particularly horrible attack. When she was 8 months pregnant with Jeremy, Scott broke her nose. Like so many victims of domestic violence, she didn't tell anyone until years later, because she was ashamed. Of course, she had nothing to be ashamed of. Laura did eventually divorce Scott because of the abuse she suffered. The divorce was final in February of 1985. At some point, Scott left the Air Force and joined the Army Reserves. From 1983 to 1990, Scott claims to have designed submarine detection systems as a project engineer for Spartan Defense Electronics. During that time frame, Scott also obtained a bachelor degree in avionics engineering from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach. In April 1990, Scott married his second wife, a woman named Ellen. They had a son, Scott Lee Jr., together before their marriage ended in 1999. From 1990 to 1993, Scott worked as a senior systems engineer for Boeing Aerospace. There, Scott says he developed a complex computer network for designing the space station. In 1993, Scott was living in Port Charlotte, Florida, which is located 100 miles south of Tampa and 65 miles north of Naples. It's in southwestern Florida off the Gulf of Mexico. Scott, a Buddhist, became an adorned Shaolin priest. The next year, he formed a nonprofit corporation called the Temple of the Tao, Inc. He also purchased a house and had it rezoned as a house of worship. The Temple of Tao was in honor of the Shaolin Temple in China. Scott described the temple as being, quote, a small center for martial arts and Chinese philosophy. It was a Chan Zen Buddhist temple dedicated to the enhancement and unification of mind, body, and spirit. According to the website, the temple offered classes in hard and soft martial arts and healing arts. along with meditation classes and personal counseling for individuals and families. The temple also held weekly Buddhist services and Buddhist educational classes. From 1998 to 2001, Scott says he taught high school computer science, physics, and math while also leading the Temple of Tao and working as a dropout prevention counselor at the Academy, an alternative high school. During that time, Scott married and divorced his third wife, a woman named Kathleen. After leaving the Academy, Scott applied for a job with Charlotte County Fire and EMS. In January 2001, he was hired by the county, and he started working as a data manager and computer technician. He was fired in March 2004 after the county received a tip that Scott had falsified a military order so he could have time off of work. In November 2002, Scott had submitted a 3-week vacation leave of absence for military orders. When the county looked into the tip, they found there had never been an order. In fact, Scott was discharged from active duty in November 2002. The day after Scott was fired, he sent an email to his supervisor, blaming the way the Army implemented his orders and deployment for his inability to prove the order was in fact real. He told his boss, "The orders were issued locally and never recorded. The unit that issued the orders had been deployed and is not here. I am screwed again. It's okay. I was underpaid anyway." Scott went on to work as the Emergency Preparedness Liaison, NCO, for Florida. He was also looking for a new wife. Following his third divorce, Scott told his mother, Joyce, "I haven't really had any luck with American women." So, he was going to use a mail order bride service. In 2002, Scott met a 26-year-old woman living in Russia named Yana Kuchinskaya. Born on January 13, 1976, in Ukraine, Yana was described by her mother as being very calm, never rude, very kind, a very good mother, and very gentle. "She was an angel," she said. Sadly, we know nothing else about Yana's childhood. Prior to meeting Scott, Yana was married once. She and her husband had one child together, a son named Peter. According to Yana's mother, Elena, when Peter was 6 months old, Yana's husband was murdered. Yana was in her third year of college and had to drop out. Elena then helped raise Peter for the next few years. After meeting Yana, Scott traveled to St. Petersburg to visit her twice. Then they decided to get married. In December 2002, Scott applied for a marriage license, and Yana was issued a visa to come to the U.S. She brought 3-year-old Peter with her. Yana and Peter remained close with Yana's mother, Elena. They spoke on the phone or webcam numerous times a day. Scott and Yana married on February 7th, 2003 at the courthouse in Murdoch, Florida. Just a little over 2 months later, Scott was charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. On April 15th, Yana called 911 to report that Scott had spanked Peter too hard and told her she and Peter were no good. Yana told Scott that if he didn't love her, he should leave. Scott grabbed his gun, walked outside the front door, and fired the gun in the air 3 times. He then turned to Yana and threatened to shoot her and, quote, feed her to the alligators. Yana and Peter fled to a women's shelter, and she filed a restraining order, the first of many. The charges were later dropped after Yana went back to Scott. At some point in 2003, Yana enrolled in the nursing program at Manatee Community College. She was supposed to graduate in the summer of 2007. Scott also enrolled in nursing classes. According to her instructors, Yana was studious, articulate, sweet, and quick to smile. She was excited about becoming a nurse. An assistant professor of nursing said she was always a well-prepared student, very caring for her patients, and supportive of her fellow students. According to the Herald Tribune, By 2004, allegations against Scott were, quote, becoming more troubling because records show they were not always pursued by sheriff's deputies. Unlike many states, Florida did not require law enforcement to arrest someone suspected of committing domestic violence. The Tribune reported that, quote, officers who respond to domestic calls have wide discretion in determining whether the abuser's actions warrant arrest. The Herald Tribune reported that the Florida justice system, quote, relies heavily on domestic violence victims to stand up for themselves, even when they face death threats from their abusers. The executive director of CARE, Center for Abuse and Rape Emergencies, told the Tribune that experts estimate that only 1 of 10 victims report abuse to law enforcement, and the majority end up dropping charges. Executive Director of Hope Family Services, Laurel Lynch, said, quote, domestic violence by its very nature isolates the victim. We can be socially isolated, physically isolated, and if you add into that mix a language barrier, it becomes very difficult for the victim to escape. More importantly, immigrants who are abused may not know their rights. I wish that they were more heavily counseled that upon entering the U.S., they are entitled to legal protection, including a visa for battered women. When applying for a visa, they are often given voluminous paperwork and pamphlets that often provide this information, but who knows how heavily these rights are stressed to the young women arriving on a marriage visa. The Herald Tribune reported that Yana always went back to Scott because he would threaten to have her deported, or worse, if she didn't drop charges. Quote, she was dependent on her husband because she spoke broken English and came to America with no job or family. According to the Tribune, experts say Florida, and specifically Charlotte County, is behind when it comes to the best tools to protect domestic violence victims who often recant out of fear or hope that the violent relationship will improve. Some states have mandatory arrest laws that require officers to take action if the slightest evidence exists. Florida does not. And worst of all, Charlotte is the only coastal county from Naples to Tampa Bay without a special domestic violence protection unit. Authorities rarely took extraordinary steps to investigate Yana's claims or gather any evidence. In 1 year, Yana took Peter to the hospital 2 times with injuries. Yana said he wasn't being abused, but medical staff called authorities anyway. During one of the visits, Peter did admit that Scott had punched him. The Tribune reported that, incredibly, deputies didn't believe there was enough evidence to pursue charges, even though DCF recommended counseling and periodic home visits after the second hospital visit. Not enough evidence? After 2 ER visits and a child who verbalized that his stepfather punched him? Whenever Yana recanted her allegations, charges were dropped without any further investigation. Dan Feinberg, who supervises the state's attorney's office in Charlotte, told the Tribune that his attorneys diligently pursued each case, but once Yana Huss declined to testify, there was little evidence. Feinberg said, quote, when she became uncooperative, there wasn't much we could do. Executive Director of Hope Family Services, Laurel Lynch, told the Tribune that she disagrees, stating, the law says you don't need a victim's testimony if you have other kinds of evidence. People say domestic violence in a courtroom, and everyone cringes because there's this belief that the only evidence is he said, she said. I don't think that's true. There's lots of evidence. Talk to the kids, the neighbors. Obviously, little Peter was trying to speak up for himself. And there were emails and phone records that could prove that at the very least, Scott frequently violated restraining orders. At one point, he even admitted to driving past the house and scaring Yana so badly that she and Peter ran into the woods. There was a restraining order at that time, and yet no charges were pursued. Another time, Scott admitted to authorities that he left numerous threatening notes for Yana. One was scrawled on a mirror. It read, "You lose." Ominously, another note was held in place with three knives and read, "I will win at your game." On February 18, 2004, Yana filed a restraining order against Scott, citing multiple occasions where Scott was physically abusive to her and Peter. Yana wrote, "The violence and abuse to my son and me is almost every day. Some days Scott cries and tells me that he is so sorry and that he really is a good, kind person." Yana wrote about how in October 2003, Scott struck Peter with a tennis racket. "He hit him hard with much anger," she wrote. Peter had a big bruise and a lot of pain. Yana begged Scott to take her son to the doctor, but he refused. Yana took a picture of the bruise, but Scott found it and deleted it from her camera. On January 19, 2004, Yana heard Peter crying in his bed during the night. When she went to see what happened, she found that Peter had wet the bed. While Yana started cleaning up her son and changing the sheets, Scott came in and, as she put it, called Peter bad names and gave him a hard spanking. Afterward, Peter had bruises. In early February, Scott pulled Peter's ear to the point of leaving a mark that was still there when Yana was filling out the restraining order weeks later on the 18th. Yana said that a few days after the ear pulling, on around the 8th, she heard Peter cry, so she ran in his room. Peter said that Scott had hit him in the face. Scott then admitted it, saying he did it because Peter didn't understand what he was saying to him. Yana told Scott he couldn't touch Peter anymore. He got mad, grabbed her arm, and began shaking her. When Scott let go, Yana took Peter outside and thought about going to the police, but she was too scared. Horrifically, Yana mentioned in the restraining order that on numerous occasions, Scott threatened to cut Peter's penis. It's unclear what this is about, though it's possible we may understand it more later in this sad story. The restraining order was granted. Scott was charged with domestic violence, and a hearing was set for late March. On February 27th, Scott was arrested for driving under the influence. He was found guilty and sentenced to a year of probation. 2 days after the DUI, Scott filed for divorce. On March 16th, he was arrested for violating Yana's restraining order. A week later, Scott withdrew his petition for divorce. 3 days later, Yana asked for the restraining order and domestic violence charges against Scott to be dropped. She stated, "My friend told me that my husband is very sad and that he loves me. And she told me he will go to a special program to stop drinking alcohol. So I think that I will let him to go to counseling and I will give him one last chance." And then 2005 seemed to be a somewhat peaceful year. Scott was not arrested and no restraining orders were filed. In April, Yana gave birth to a daughter with Scott, who they named Katrina. A month later, Scott successfully completed his year of probation for the DUI. In September, Scott bought a house on 1 acre in the 2000 block of Rickover Street in Port Charlotte. According to Zillow, the house has 4 beds, 2 baths, and a large foyer with double entry doors. The house was the only one on the street. It was surrounded by thick brush and a 6-foot-tall wooden fence. Sadly, the year 2006 would be the same as 2003 and 2004, with numerous 911 calls and restraining orders. Scott was drinking heavily again and had quite a few financial problems. Multiple credit card companies won judgments against him for more than $57,000 in unpaid debts. Scott then transferred the property of his Rickover Street home to his mother Joyce in the Temple of Tao. In March 2006, Yana filed a restraining order stating that Scott had choked Peter and hit their 11-month-old daughter, Katrina. Yana said when she confronted him, Scott acted like he was going to reach for a gun, so she called 911. But then, Scott cut the phone line and told Yana he would shoot her and Peter if they reported anything to the police or any other agency. In her restraining order application, Yana wrote, "Scott told me he is going to kill me if I call the police." Not only was there a gun in a violent household, the word choked should have been a major red flag. And Scott was abusing children. Surely children could not ask for charges to be dropped. On April 22nd, Yana told the police that she walked in on Scott as he appeared to be fondling their one-year-old daughter. Scott was charged with battery for touch or strike and a sex offense against a child. I wonder now if the threats about cutting Peter's penis were related to this charge about Katrina. Yana also said that Scott had been physically abusing her and Peter, so Scott was charged with domestic violence as well. But incredibly, again, all charges were later dropped due to lack of evidence. On July 15th, Scott drove his Porsche into a concrete pole at a gas station. He then fled on foot. The next morning, a man at a nearby golf course called Yana and told her that Scott was running around the course disoriented. Officers were called and they charged Scott with a reduced charge of reckless driving. He pled guilty and was sentenced to 2 days in jail. Why wasn't he also charged with leaving the scene of an accident? And it's pretty obvious he was drunk. But he had completed his 1 year's probation, so I guess his first DUI didn't matter in this incident. From July 2006 through February of 2007, police were called to the Huss home 19 times for various reasons. Then on March 26th, Yana filed for a restraining order, claiming that Scott attacked the children. Scott was charged with domestic violence, and finally, a restraining order was put into place. Starting April 3rd, officers worried about Yana's safety and checked in on her and the kids at their Rickover Street home around once a day. Finally, they were worried after years of calls from Yana. On April 5th, Yana went to the sheriff's office to report that Scott had called her 38 times that day, telling her, "You're done, bitch." That isn't just a threat. That sounds like a death threat. While she was making the report, Scott even called her twice. But nothing was done because the officer said he couldn't verify that Scott was the one making the calls. I just do not understand this. Yana would contact the police 7 other times to report that Scott was harassing her with phone calls, emails, and online messages. On April 11th, Yana filed for divorce. She had finally made some friends, and according to them, she was feeling like she could provide for her family without Scott. She was about to finish nursing school and start a new job. She and the kids could afford a fresh start. 2 days later, Yana called the police to say that Scott had snuck into the house via a back door while she was letting the dogs out. He refused to leave. When deputies pulled up, Yana ran out crying. Officers reported she appeared to be extremely scared as she was crying and screaming and yelling in a panic that her ex-husband was still in the house. Scott was arrested for violating the restraining order and spent the night in jail. Of course, the next day, he was released on bond. Not long after his release, Scott called his son Jeremy out of the blue and told him that Yana had ruined his life and scammed him for money, and things of that nature. But the most shocking thing Scott said was that Yana needed to die. It does not appear that Jeremy reported this threat. On April 17th, less than a week later, Scott posted a long rant online. "I married a Russian woman 4 years ago, and she has implicated me on domestic violence charges on 4 or 5 occasions. There has been no domestic violence in the home ever, and I am now sure that it was just immigration marriage fraud. I loved her, and she played me for the fool, following the now ever-popular checklist that is readily available to them to use to destroy someone's life. I may have been duped, like a lot of American military men, but the USCIS is not really doing anything about it. 3 years ago, the USCIS was going to deport her because of the significant pressure I put on them through and with congressional help. I stopped them from deporting her because I let my heart get in the way of my mind. I am going to work for the rest of my life to fix this problem, and I need help. I need help and hope that the show can do something to help thousands of people. When you hear me say something kind of loudly, that's when he is using all caps. 2 days after making the post, Scott filed domestic violence charges against Yana. It's unclear what his claims were. But it's incredible. I keep using that word because I just can't believe it. How many times did that poor woman call for help? How many times did the police fail her? How many times did DCF fail her? How many times did hospital workers who saw bruises on little Peter try to help Yana and Peter? It's sickening. A week after Scott's claims against Yana, after all of these systematic failures, Yana would die. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. Southern Fried listeners understand the ugly realities of our world, that some missing people get more attention from the media than others. Wondery's podcast, The Vanished, changes that. Hosted by Marissa Jones, she tells the stories of those missing persons cases that haven't received the media attention they deserve. I've known Marissa for years, and she is one of the most ethical and caring podcasters I know. Marissa uncovers the details of their mysterious disappearance from interviews with family, friends, law enforcement, and sometimes even suspects. She reminds the listeners of the human behind the headline and does all she can to uncover what really happened. Some recent episodes have explored the disappearance of Jimmy Robinson, who swung by his parents' house with an unidentified male passenger in his car, never to be seen again, and the case of Sandra Eckhart, where Jones digs deep into the series of events preceding her disappearance with the main person of interest, her husband. Listen to The Vanished on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, or listen 1 week early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Now, a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. As a writer, I do my best to take care of my mind. Brain breaks, as I call them, are so important. I need to stay alert and focused, so I plan small breaks to engage my brain, whether it's a game on my phone or reading a couple of chapters in a book. There are plenty of ways to support a healthy brain, like learning a new language or taking power naps. There's also BetterHelp online therapy. I've been through a lot in the last few years with surgeries and losing my mom, so I have depended so much on therapy to help me through it. BetterHelp has made it so much easier to connect with someone I feel safe talking to. They offer video, phone, and even live chat only therapy sessions, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. And it's much more affordable than in-person therapy. You can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Southern Fried listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/southern. That's BETTERHELP.com/southern. On Sunday, April 22, 2007, Scott showed up at Yana's church looking for her. A congregation member named Barbara told Scott to leave. Barbara then called the police, and Scott was issued a trespassing warning when he lingered in the area. Because Scott was looking for her, Yana and the children stayed at a shelter instead of their home that evening. For the next 2 nights, she stayed with the owner of Katrina's daycare. She then put down a $1,000 deposit on her own condo. She finally had her own money and had found the courage as well as community support to try and escape Scott. But it was too late. On April 23rd, Peter's second grade teacher, Carol, called Yana to ask why Peter wasn't in school. Yana, who sounded hysterical, screamed that she and her children were being threatened by Scott. Carol said she went to the school's guidance counselor, Dan, to report that Yana and the kids were in danger. When Peter showed up at the school that day, the guidance counselor Dan pulled him out of class to talk. When Peter went back to the classroom, Carol asked what was going on. He said Scott choked him and put a gun to his head. It does not appear that Dan nor Carol ever notified the principal or authorities. What in the holy hell is wrong with these people? How could they not call the police after a child tells them such a horrific story? Are they not also trained to look for signs of abuse and do something about it? The next day, Yana spent the evening studying for two final exams. She was finishing up nursing school and was set to start a nursing job the next day. On April 25th, Yana woke up at around 6:15 a.m. She left Katrina with a daycare provider. Then she and Peter went to the family home to check in on their pets and get a few belongings before she dropped Peter off at school. Peter walked to the bathroom to brush his teeth and found Scott waiting there. He had a gun and a knife on him. Scott told 8-year-old Peter to stay in the bathroom and don't come out, no matter what. Peter didn't listen and walked after Scott. That's when he heard his mom scream. Peter ran towards the noise and saw his mom running to the laundry room where there was a burglar alarm panel. He heard Yana say no to something Scott said. After that, he got really mad, Peter said. And then Peter watched as Scott stabbed his mom 5 or 6 times. Peter took off, running all over the house to find a phone, but then he accidentally ran into Scott, who then made him get in the car. While driving away, Scott wiped the blood off of his hands and told Peter to tell investigators that a black man with brown hair and black eyes came to the house and killed his mom. It's amazing to me that he didn't also kill Peter, the young witness to his mother's brutal murder. Scott drove 3 hours north to his mother Joyce's house in Longwood and dropped Peter off in the street out front at 11 a.m. All he had was a suitcase. Joyce later testified that she thought it was weird that Scott dropped Peter off without coming in. She called Scott and he told her, "Don't tell anyone. Don't call anybody." And she obeyed. 10 minutes later, Joyce took Peter with her to pick up her other son, Michael. As soon as Michael got into Joyce's vehicle, he noticed some bloodstains on Peter's shirt. Peter then explained that his mother was stabbed in the arm by a black man who broke into the house and she was in the hospital. Neither Michael nor Joyce called the police, and they all went to lunch like nothing happened. At around 1 p.m., Joyce dropped Michael off back at home. Before Michael got out of the car, Peter told them, "My mom is dead. My mom is dead." Joyce still didn't call the police. Instead, she took Peter to Walmart to buy new clothes, since his were all bloody. On the way, Peter told her, "If she is dead, I may be here a long time." When they got back to Joyce's, she opened the suitcase Peter had with him. Inside was a will, a document giving custody of Katrina to Joyce, and a 12-page typed letter, which Joyce skimmed over. It appeared to be a suicide note, so she called Michael, who came over. They read it together. Because the letter is so long, I am going to try and summarize it the best I can. You can find a link to the full text in my show notes. Again, I will be emphasizing the words that are capitalized. The long and rambling letter started with a rules page. "Mom, this letter is not to be read by you until you are contacted by me, unless I cannot contact you. You must promise to abide by the rules of this letter as I state them. This is not a fucking joke. It is time for you to earn my trust." Scott then wrote out a list of guidelines for how Joyce was supposed to divide his assets. Scott told his mother, "Do not make a mistake." One of the things he wanted her to do was sell his house for around $425,000 and then distribute the money into trusts for 4 of his children, Katrina, Scott Lee Jr., Danielle, and Jeremy. Naturally, nothing for Peter. the child he had just orphaned. Scott wanted his $400,000 military insurance payout to be distributed in a very specific way, with some of the money going to his children. Part of the money should go toward a Scott Lee Corvette fund. He told his mother to make it happen so he can have a Corvette on his driver's license day. Tell Ellen, Scott Jr.'s mother, that she better back the fuck off or I will take care of her too. I expect you to do justice to me, Mom. Do not call Dad right away. Listen for once. Do not think you are smart about any of this. Just listen. Do as I have said. Do it well and make me proud. Do not let your dogs get in the way of this grave matter. Do it well. Scott signed his name on the list of demands, then continued with another rambling paragraph. I want special consideration to be given to Katrina to protect her forever. I want her to know the truth when it is time. I have never loved anything as much as her. Keep this confidential, Mom, because I also love Scott Lee like no other. She is just a baby, a perfect one. You must do as I say and do not stray. Pay attention closely to my words. Do not stray. I will be watching. His words about Katrina make me sick to my stomach in light of what Yana saw him do to his daughter. Next came the actual letter portion. It started with, "This letter in its entirety must be distributed to each party listed within the letter. Also, the office must be supplied to the highest level of Homeland Security, not some field office, and Congress. This also must be supplied to the media and law enforcement last. Law enforcement has no business in this matter. They have caused so much of it to exacerbate due to their gross inadequacies. Everyone should read this in its entirety to begin to understand the magnitude and the truth. It is lengthy, but it will be rewarding because a movie will be made in honor of Scott L. Huss. Preserve this for my children, all of them. I did not scream. I did not abuse. I only loved and hurt, gave it all away for nothing. It did not have to end this way." Scott wrote, "Nobody would listen to the truth. He asked for help many times from the police, clergy, and more. He said, the only victims are me, Scott L. Huss Jr., and Katrina and Peter." He continued, "Nobody cares and nobody is willing to do anything about it. I loved her more than anybody could realize and she duped me. You, the country, immigration, everybody. You bunch of hypocritical idiots. All you had to do was give her a polygraph test. I took one last year based on her crap and passed it with flying colors. Why don't you guys stop looking at this from the angle that you do and wake up? It is my fault and my responsibility for allowing this horrible person entry into America. She is part of a network, a ring, that does exactly what she has done. Enough! This is the most unprofessional joke of a sheriff's office and judicial system that I could ever imagine. This country has gone to hell. I cannot imagine trying to raise a child to believe in this nonsense when I don't even know why I have served this country for many years. You people miss the truth. The woman is a liar, manipulator, actress, and destroyer. She is dangerous. She wants me dead. Her theatrics are so blatantly obvious, I cannot believe the sheriff's office does not have people trained to recognize this." Side note, I have no idea if anything about the supposed polygraph test is true, but I highly doubt it. These are the ravings of a man completely out of control. And of course, he blames Yana for all of it. Nothing he says about her in this manifesto is true. Scott wrote that after Yana moved to Florida, she showed significant bipolar tendencies, he said. She would go from hot to cold in seconds, screaming at me, her son, my son, etc. I thought it was culture shock, trip stress or something. After they married, the nightmares began. She had him arrested numerous times and every time the case was dropped because she, quote, admitted to fabricating the allegations. Scott said that after Yana had him charged for touching the children, he passed a polygraph and proved his, quote, integrity, honesty, and credibility, something Yana has never done. He wrote, "I know this is Mayberry and the sheriff's office is filled with uneducated idiots, but you have allowed this total misrepresentation of the judicial system. Look at yourselves and admit that you are all failures. I told you many times, but you would not listen. Scott wrote, she is radically bipolar and a true nightmare to live with. She shows schizophrenia-type tendencies every day, too. She is horribly abusive, and it is killing everybody. He claims in the letter that Peter had severe ADHD due to Yana's abuse, but there is no proof of this claim, like anything else he says in this letter. Scott said, she is a liar, actor, and she can fool our stupid judicial system without any problem. It needs to stop before somebody really gets hurt. Scott wrote, 3 years ago, the USCIS was going to deport Yana and her son due to the severity of her actions then, but I stopped them while they were en route to the Charlotte County Justice Center during one of our many hearings. I did not want to believe this woman is a fraud and that she would be capable of doing such horrible things, but I am not the only one to blame in this. The Charlotte County Sheriff's Office, the Charlotte County Judicial System, children and families, and most every organization known to mankind in the area are all responsible. He is somewhat right in that section, only it's the other way around. All of those organizations failed to protect Yana and Peter. Scott went on and on ranting about Yana, claiming that before he met her, he only had a few traffic violations. Yeah, because his other three wives were too terrified of him to press charges. He makes more ludicrous claims of Yana abusing her children before he goes into a cliched rant, seemingly about mail-order brides. He wrote, she wants to shop and have some free service to take care of everything. She needs to feed off of someone who will bankroll her. It is a classic pattern. The Russian women are trained to do this. She began after the murder of her first husband. It is who she is. And you stupid, pathetic, wretched, spoiled Americans think I am the bad guy. Stupid, stupid. I hate stupid. This next part is in all caps. I can't keep yelling it for you or I'll blow out your eardrums. For all those people that actually know me, you know the truth. You know who I am and what I do. I love my family, my children, my wives, my friends, and all of you people. I have a great heart, a great capacity for love. I love God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit. I have been forgiven already, and I long to go home. This world sucks and has not been good to me ever. I give and the world takes. I have nothing else to give except my life to God. I ask that Jesus accept me into his arms for healing. This world has hurt me. I am tired. Then Scott wrote specific notes to the people in his life, to his children, not Peter, of course, to people he hates, and more. To Yana, Scott wrote, I loved you like no other. I cannot forgive you anymore. I pray that you have a relationship with Jesus and he forgives you for what you have done. I hope to see you on the other side. Perhaps there you will see my love for you. Classic abuser. It's her fault, not his. To Scott Jr., he wrote, forgive your mother, Ellen, for her horrible nature and what she has done. She is too stupid to know better. Forgive me for having to go, but I cannot be treated so badly anymore. Your mother started all of this because of her stupid big fat mouth. She will pay dearly for what she has done. Side note, it's unclear what Ellen had to do with any of this. Ellen and her husband did file domestic charges against Scott numerous times. This happened at the same time Yana filed. It's unclear what the allegations were, and I don't think he was ever convicted. Scott continued on to his son, quote, I will watch over you forever, and you and Katrina will sit at my side in heaven. I gave all of myself to you and your learning and well-being. I was only happy when you were with me. I did not send you to the neighbor's daughter to watch you. I played with you, every game you played. I did not do some games very good, but I tried. You are the best. You are the one. I wish I could hug you one last time. Oh, God. Scott then wrote a paragraph for everybody. There is truly something good inside all of us, even Yana. I loved her because I have the ability to see the good in her in spite of the bad. Her bad was influenced by bad people, her friends, her family, attorneys, some Russian network of fraud, and she took ridiculous actions that hurt everybody. Her good was very good and was deeply rooted in culture and tradition. She just could not get it all together, and she was a horrible communicator. Ellen is a good example of the horror that influences people in an unspeakable way. When Ellen leaves the earth, the angels will sing. She is possessed by something horrible. Jesus has forgiven me as I gave my heart and life to him long ago. For Homeland Security. When a decorated military person comes to you with a serious allegation, that is a matter of life or death or national security. You must take action immediately. You failed miserably. Your organization must be totally reconstructed. Immigration fraud is an epidemic, and they are coming in by the thousands every year. I cannot believe we let anyone come in, and I made the mistake of falling for it, but when I cried for help, nobody listened. Go figure, only in America. Scott's writing ended abruptly after that statement. The rest of the letter is an article entitled Green Card Girls. It was about women who scam men for green cards. Many people might read Scott's manifesto and try to diagnose his mental health. I am not so willing to see him that way. He knew what he was doing. He never took responsibility for anything in his entire adult life. And as we will see, he will be cocky enough to take the stand when he goes to trial. Whatever he may have been suffering from would not be an excuse. After reading through this long letter, Scott's mother and brother finally called the Longwood police. It was around 2:40 p.m., nearly 4 hours after Peter was dropped off. The Longwood police then contacted Port Charlotte to ask for a welfare check to be conducted. Officers went over to the Huss home on Rickover Street and found that the front door was unlocked. In the laundry room, they discovered Yana's body. She had 11 slash and stab wounds on her neck, breast, and genitals. It doesn't take a psychologist to see the sexual component to his rage toward Yana. Many of the wounds could have been fatal. Her heart, liver, diaphragm, and right lung were all punctured, and her neck was slashed so deeply that her head was nearly decapitated. It's doubtful those 4 hours would have made a difference in life or death for Yana, but at least Peter would have been out of the hands of his stepfamily, who obviously did not care about him or his mother. Under Yana's fingernails was a mixture of her DNA and that of a single Caucasian male, which Scott could not be excluded from. She had defensive wounds on both hands and arms. There were two sets of bloody footprints in nearly every room of the house, including footprints leading out to where Scott had parked. One set belonged to Scott, who had taken off his shoes before he entered the house. Investigators theorized he took his shoes off so he wouldn't be heard. The other set belonged to Peter. He had been wearing his tennis shoes. None of the footprints were Yana's. It's obvious she died in that small laundry room where she was cornered before she was viciously attacked. There was also a 160-page packet of papers found at the scene. Near the end of a document entitled, How to Change Your Identity, Scott's fingerprint was on it. Investigators went to Joyce's house to speak with Peter. They asked why he told Joyce that a black man stabbed his mom in the arm. Peter replied, "He made me say that happened. I lied because I'm afraid of him. I was afraid he'd hurt me like he did my mom." Police issued a warrant for Scott's arrest for manslaughter. They chose to go with manslaughter because at the time, they felt like they only had enough information for that charge. Investigators went to speak with Scott's first wife, Laura. When asked if she thought Scott was capable of killing someone, Laura responded, "I think deep down for a number of years, I always had this feeling inside me that something bad was really going to happen relating to Scott." At around 9 p.m., Scott called his mother, Joyce. Michael answered the phone, and Scott said, "My wife is dead." When asked how he knew this, Scott didn't really say anything, so Michael asked, "Well?" Scott explained to Michael that prior to Yana's murder, he had been at the bar drinking with four of his friends. He said he was spilling his guts to them about all the horrible stuff Yana had done to him. He said, "I really think one of those four guys went over to my house and killed her." When Michael asked why he thought that, Scott said, "Well, they asked me all these questions and, you know." Obviously, Scott wasn't too disturbed to try and blame Yana's murder on anyone but himself. Michael asked where Scott was, and he said, "I'm far, far away in a hotel, and I'm not going to go back to Port Charlotte. I'll probably never go back to Port Charlotte. They're going to try and pin this rap on me. I know, because she filed for divorce yesterday, and now she's dead, and they're going to try and pin it on me because I've been in jail so many times, and she's had me, you know, put in jail. I'm not going to go to jail for this. I didn't do this. I had nothing to do with it." That part about all his times in jail is ludicrous. He rarely even spent the night when he was actually arrested. Michael told Scott he had read the letter, which freaked Scott out because he told Joyce not to let anyone read it. Clearly, his mom and brother messed up his escape plans, because Michael told Scott that the police knew about it too. Scott replied, "Port Charlotte knows about it. I've got to go. Bye," and hung up. At around 9:30 p.m., Scott sent an email to his mom from Tallahassee. Port Charlotte officers then contacted Tallahassee authorities, who started searching hotel parking lots for Scott's rental car. When officers located the car at a Best Western, they went inside and found that Scott had rented a room under his name, but he wasn't there. He recently hired a cab to go somewhere. Officers called the cab company and found that Scott was dropped off at Beer Barn. They got a description of what he was wearing from surveillance video. At around 11 p.m., another officer saw Scott walking in a parking lot near a Greyhound bus station. The officer pulled in front of Scott and told him to put his hands up. Scott reached into his waistband, but just then, backup arrived. Scott started complying, and he was arrested without incident. He had $2,900 in cash and a bus ticket to Houston. The name on the ticket was an alias. Investigators believed he was headed to Mexico. In Scott's hotel room, investigators found a police scanner, hair dye kit, clothing, towels, a watch with Yana's blood on it, and more. When investigators looked inside Scott's car, they found Yana's purse and her blood. The blood found on Peter's shirt was also found to be Yana's. I'm going to pause now for a final commercial break. Investigators found out that Scott called his son Jeremy at some point between the murder and his arrest. Jeremy later testified that the brief call was a little disturbing. Scott told his son, quote, "I took care of my problems and I don't know when I will talk to you again or if I will ever talk to you again. I love you." 48-year-old Scott pled not guilty to manslaughter charges and was given no bond. The charges were later upgraded to second-degree murder. According to the Port Charlotte Sun, the prosecution did not offer any plea deals. Following Yana's murder, Sheriff John Davenport told the media, quote, "The officer said you could see this starting to escalate. Scott definitely had a temper. It's a shame. You don't know whether it could have been prevented. The victim does have some responsibility to seek help. She could have gone to CARE, the Center for Abuse and Rape Emergencies, and gotten help." Mother of God, he is literally blaming the dead woman, a woman who called for help so many times that I've lost count. This could have been prevented. The executive director of CARE told the Port Charlotte Sun, "You have court records that show that at various times Yana made an effort to have her voice heard, hoping to have domestic violence services protect her." Yana's reverend told the Herald Tribune that Yana did everything to escape. He said, "I think Yana reached out to as many people as she could. I think she did as much as she could." Both Katrina and Peter were placed in foster care until it could be decided where they would go. Authorities had a difficult time finding Yana's family since they lived overseas. Yana's youngest sister called her mom Elena on April 27th to say she had heard from a friend in the United States that Yana had been murdered. Elena and her two surviving daughters wanted to fly over immediately, but they had to wait a day for their visas to be approved. They arrived in Florida on April 29th. Following Scott's arrest, DCF sought to terminate his parental rights to two-year-old Katrina. Finally, they were doing something for these children. It was a tricky situation, though, because Scott's 76-year-old mother, Joyce, wanted custody of only Katrina, while Yana's mother, Elena, wanted custody of both children. Elena ended up moving to Florida so she could be near her grandchildren until DCF decided where to place the children. A friend of Yana's told the Port Charlotte Sun that Peter became like an adult after watching his mother get murdered. She said you can tell this tragedy turned his life upside down. After his grandmother came to visit, he became a different person. He would laugh and be happy. Dr. Robert Silver, a family psychologist, met with Peter multiple times over the summer of 2007. He testified that Peter did not want to discuss the murder during their meetings. He seemed to cope by suppressing the memories or even denying it. However, Peter's fear of Scott was consistent. Dr. Silver said, Peter remained terrified of his stepfather. He seemed worried that he would get out of jail and hurt him. When someone mentioned Peter testifying against Scott in court, the young boy hid under a table. In September, a judge revoked Scott's parental rights over Katrina and ruled that Peter and Katrina's new guardian would be Yana's mother, Elena. The children were also allowed to move to Russia with her. Before they went back, Peter gave a video-recorded deposition about what he witnessed, just in case he couldn't fly back for the trial. On November 29, 2010, opening statements in Scott's trial began. The prosecution told the jury that Yana's murder was a crime of passion. Scott was full of rage toward Yana. Peter was supposed to fly back to Florida to testify at the trial. But a few weeks before the trial began, Yana's family told authorities that they would not be attending. They had grown anxious from years of delays, and they did not want to traumatize Peter. The prosecution ended their case by playing the deposition from Peter, which was recorded in October 2007. After talking about how Scott told him to tell police that a black man killed his mother, Peter said he didn't tell police that because I knew if I lied, he wouldn't get in jail, and I want him to go to jail for what he did. Defense attorneys were allowed to question the boy in the deposition, and during cross-examination, the defense tried to paint Peter as a liar. He admitted that he liked to lie when he was younger, but he stopped because he realized it wasn't good to lie. The defense told the jury that Scott was innocent. He loved his wife, even though she made false allegations of abuse against him. Scott didn't kill Yana. She was killed by a dark figure from the Russian mafia who was mad at Yana because she had disobeyed orders or prolonged efforts from the Russian underworld in efforts to gain access to Scott's assets. Scott took the stand in his defense and testified for around 5 hours. He said he didn't kill Yana. He said he loved her so much. He said he also loved their daughter Katrina, and he loved Peter like his own son. Scott testified that he never yelled at Yana and wasn't sure why she filed charges against him. He said, "We didn't argue. We didn't scream. I taught her English. We had a calm, loving relationship." He claimed, not long after they married, Yana changed. She would disappear for days at a time. Twice he found her in Miami, he said. One of those times he found her with an ex-boyfriend at a motel. When Scott went to pick her up both times, he saw strange men in dark SUVs watching her. Scott testified that on the day before Yana's murder, she gave him a prepaid cell phone. On the day of her murder, Yana called Scott and told him she was scared. Scott went over to the family home to check on her. When he pulled up, he saw two dark SUVs outside the house and a dark figure climbing into one of them. The SUV drove away and Scott walked up to the house. Before he entered, he took off his shoes because the family always took off their shoes when inside. When he went inside, Scott saw Peter, blood, and Yana's legs. Scott said he was worried about the Russian mafia, so he took Peter to his mother's house, then fled town. He didn't call authorities to report Jana's death because he was scared they wouldn't believe him. He was so scared that he wanted to change his identity. When his defense attorney asked why his DNA could have been found under Jana's fingernails, Scott said he grabbed Jana's hands and checked her pulse. Scott also explained that when he wrote the manifesto, he thought he was going to be killed. It wasn't a suicide note, he insisted. The Charlotte Sun reported that Scott's cross-examination was heated, and that the prosecution brought up how Scott said the family always took their shoes off before they went in the house, but of course, Peter had his shoes on the day he watched his mother be murdered. Despite what the Sun reported as a heated confrontation, those seemed to be the only two things brought up in the cross-examination. Perhaps they knew Scott had already lost. Everything he said was clearly bullshit. The only other person who testified for the defense was a retired U.S. Immigration and Customs agent, though it's unclear as to what they testified to. On December 3rd, after deliberating for less than an hour, the jury found Scott guilty of second-degree murder. According to the Port Charlotte Sun, Scott sat stone-faced as the verdict was read. On January 12, 2011, Scott's sentencing hearing was held. He continued to maintain his innocence, telling the judge, "The Russians have won this battle." He said he would keep working to clear his name. In time, the truth will be revealed. While Jana's family did not attend the trial or sentencing hearing, they did submit victim impact statements. The now 12-year-old Peter wrote, "I tremble every day when I think of this ugly man. The time I lived with him and my mother in Florida has been a time of sadness, a time of mishandling, and a loss of children years for my sister and me. My dream is the whole situation will change and my mother will be with me." Scott was sentenced to prison without the possibility of parole. The judge called Scott's actions brutal and vicious, saying there was overwhelming evidence to prove the murder was premeditated. He said, "I think the state probably could have made a case for premeditation." The judge was referring to how investigators had found that Scott started working on his manifesto months before Jana was murdered. "I could not agree more. It's so obvious he planned it. He laid in wait for Jana. And in Florida, he could have and should have faced the death penalty." The judge told Scott, "You stabbed your wife savagely. She was aware of what was happening to her. Divorce is a way of ending a troublesome marriage. You chose not to do that. You instead committed a horrendous act." Today, Scott is incarcerated in the Sumter Correctional Institute in Bushnell. As I said, there may be some fair assessment as to Scott Huss's mental health. He did seem very paranoid at times, and at least one of his ex-wives called him disturbed. But he proved he knew exactly what he was doing, what he was planning when he wrote that manifesto. And he did not plead diminished capacity. He still lied and tried to blame some mysterious shadow men for Jana's brutal murder. But really, the worst part of this case is not even Scott's brutality. That was painfully predictable. It is the absolute systemic failure to protect Jana and her son. How many times does a woman have to call 911, ask for a restraining order, take her child to the hospital? I don't care how well she spoke English. I don't care if she declined to press charges. Anyone with half a brain should have known how frightened and isolated she was. Police and DCF are supposedly trained to look for these signs of abuse. Hospital workers did their best, but all those times that charges were dropped due to a supposed lack of evidence were not because of Jana. It's because the police failed to actually investigate what were very serious charges. Not only was this monster viciously abusing his wife and stepson, he was clearly stalking her. Everything he did pointed to Jana's eventual murder. Intimate partner abuse is often called murder in slow motion, and that definitely seems to be the case for Yana. For years, she begged for help, and it fell on deaf ears, until her abuser planned her murder, lay in wait, and viciously stabbed her to death in front of her young son. Life in prison isn't enough for Scott Huss, and I am so glad that Peter and Katrina are being raised far away from the influences of Scott's mother and family. Clearly, they made excuses for him and ignored the danger Yana, Peter, and Katrina were in. They don't deserve a relationship with those precious children. Southern Fried True Crime is hosted and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was written by Haley Gray and myself, and researched by Haley Gray. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. If you or anyone you know is experiencing intimate partner violence, please seek help. I have U.S. and international resources listed in today's show notes. If you have any case suggestions, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, and go to the listener suggestion tab. This is the best way for me to get to those little-known cases y'all always send me. Please remember that I do not accept suggestions on social media private messages. With 3 platforms to manage, that is very overwhelming for me. I hope you understand. But please come join our Facebook group, Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group, where we swap recipes, worship Dolly Parton, and share memes. I much prefer spending my social media time in our lovely group. We do, of course, discuss true crime, not just Southern Fried, but all kinds. But it is still very much a Southern lifestyle group. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shit asses allowed. It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, please don't forget to subscribe, and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on all large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, and Spotify. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.